Well, welcome back, everybody. Here we are still on Cambridge Inside Out, and I'm still Robert. And over there is still
Patrick Barrett.
Mr. Barrett. So one thing we didn't talk about so much, I don't think, in the last half hour, but it's probably worth noting, is that every year around this time of year, we have these the inevitable gift from the city manager's office, which is known as the budget for the next fiscal year. So in this case, it would be the FY 2024 fiscal, the City of Cambridge budget, And there were a few notable things about it, fair to say. One thing is probably there was the initial alarm, which was that to just look at the sort of the bottom line number, it made it look as if, even though inflation is, I don't know, up there, that we were going to jump by like a 10% increase in 1 year in the city budget.
10% increase from what, Robert?
It's a 10% increase from what was already a pretty high number, and would actually put the full city operating budget up to $866,254,920, right? Now, which is actually 9.9% increase over the previous year, right? That's faster than inflation. Now, and by the way, it's not like we had a small budget of underfunded everything prior. We've been funding a lot of things, so now we want to seem to grow exponentially, it seems.
But the good news is, Robert, for the $867 million, we're getting the best schools in America. The streets are paved with gold. Business is great. Our police and fire are well-funded, and everything is just perfect.
Well, I'll actually speak up very highly for some of the things on your list. I think we actually do a pretty good job with our police department and our fire department, which is actually one of the best rated in the state.
We have the best police department and the best fire department I've ever seen.
Right. Actually other communities actually look to Cambridge for assistance in some matters of this. So I think, we do certain things really, really well. On the other hand, anybody who's driven through Cambridge now knows that, there may be nice spanking new bike lanes, but the thing is a lot of roads are falling apart right now too, so we don't do everything exactly perfectly, but there's some other things that I found quite interesting, and again, I'm not doing this just to rag on city management. That's not my intention, but with the full acknowledgement that there were the last few years when we were going without a deputy city manager, and maybe we were leaving a few positions unfilled. Some of that was in order to free up money for COVID, by the way. But back in once upon a time, the city manager's office had a total of about 5 people in it, right? And then they were all the city departments, of which were many, right? Up to just a few years ago, it was about 11 people working out of the city manager's office. In fiscal 22, it went up to 16. In fiscal 23, that went up to 22. And now in the FY 2024 budget, the city manager's office now has 31 full-time employees.
So maybe
I don't know what, how, what are you managing? You got 31 people in there?
You're taking a page of the Mark Wahlberg Puff Daddy sort of strategy where you want to have a posse. It's not intimidating to walk around. There's 9 counselors. There's only 1 manager. You want to have your people with you.
I guess. Now, listen, I think it's the prerogative of any new city manager to reshuffle things and do some rearrangements. And maybe there are certain positions that have been operating in certain places that they're now going to be operating within that house. So maybe all of this adds up and makes some sense in here. But, over the last 6 months, I've been reading things like how we're going to create the new people officer. And I think, was there the talent officer? These rather curious new positions that are all being created in here.
What does a people officer do?
I think it's just this is probably the director of personnel, but you don't want to call it the director of personnel because it sounds so cold and gray. So we call it the chief people officer. I think, geez, they ought to wear freaking Mickey Mouse ears while they're doing right?
I'm imagining sort of a ridiculous position where someone's going around like making sure there are people here. And you're like, well,
I don't know.
The Ministry of Silly Walks.
Yeah. Now, one other thing that was really quite sort of startling at first, but it's been at least partially explained, was it looked, when you first looked at the, you know, and I sort of, you know, printed out the, you know, the whole budget stuff in here, and I did year-to-year comparisons, and it made it look like as if the community development department had increased this budget by like 172%. I thought, hold on, whoa, what's going on here? So because the budget book was not available until 5:30 p.m. Monday, and even there, you couldn't get a physical copy. Apparently, it was explained that, for reasons which I think are worth talking about a bit, the money from the Affordable Housing Trust, which is, I guess, part of the capital budget, as it was explained to me, I'm not always the best at understanding the distinction between all these different categories, but was moved into the operating budget within, you know, housed within the Community Development Department. I believe, based on some of the rhetoric from some city councilors last night, that the idea was basically have money just sort of sitting there at the ready, in case you see a real estate listing for some property, so the city can quick pounce on it and just buy stuff straight out of operating funds. Now, that to me seems a little questionable as a practice, but that seemed to be what Councilor McGovern was suggesting this was about. So I don't know.
When you got $186 million bustling about, you know, it's hard to keep track of the details, Robert.
Yeah.
But I think as a parent in Cambridge, of two young children whom I took out of our public school system, and I'm happy to say that my children are thriving and doing quite well where they are now, private school that I pay for, I am a little bit outraged consistently that in the land of Bob Moses, where algebra has been removed from eighth grade, where the average cost per pupil is over $37,000, which, by the way, is more than what I'm paying for private school per student, that we can somehow look at that and say, gosh, aren't we doing great? I am embarrassed by that fact. And I think the council should be, the mayor, especially since she's the head of the school committee. And it's just, to my mind, it's a legacy of failure that we continually congratulate ourselves for that has just, for some reason, just gone unrecognized. And I don't understand that.
Well, you know, self-congratulation seems to be sort of part of what we do. And again, let me do my disclaimer here. I'm not trying to rag on the city so much, but I was talking to somebody earlier today about public information and public information officers and whatever. And I love the people who actually work for as public information people for the city. I consider friends. I like them. I really like them. But the thing is that public information for the city of Cambridge is really almost like public relations flyers. You know, like, look at us, aren't we wonderful, as opposed to actually just factual information, you know? So, I mean, if you want to actually get information, can you always get it? Well, sometimes, yeah, you know, sometimes no, you know, but the thing is that public information is really, you know, as I say, it's more, I mean, I remember 20 something years ago when Kathy Bourne was on the council, maybe when Jim Browdy was on there, they used to say how we need to tell our story to the people so that, because people don't seem to know how wonderful we are. And they started creating these various parts of city government whose sole job was basically to promote themselves, to promote what the city does. Right. I said, well, great. You know, I think sometimes the public schools love to promote, you know, this sort of the positive initiatives that they like to be associated with. I don't know that they necessarily are all that thrilled to actually put out information about how kids are doing in math.
I can guarantee you they're not. And that's something that, as again, as a parent with a child who was in CPS, didn't realize until that was turned up to the volume of 11 during the pandemic, where I saw just how deficient it was. And I just, to my mind, no, there's no problem that's unsolvable and there's no issue that's not tackled. But in terms of the most important issues facing our city, Buda, bike lanes, climate, whatever, all of those pale in comparison to the future of the city, which are the children of the city, who we consistently fail. And for some reason, put out a glowing report saying how gosh darn great we are at doing it. And it's just like, to my mind, it's just aggravating, frustrating. And I'm not ragging on the city, but they don't deserve a pat on the back. And I don't believe in participation awards. However, the real elephant in the room in all of this outside of school budgets or any other budgets, is how our budgets are paid for, which is predominantly through commercial taxation. And we've got some trouble ahead, my friend.
Yeah, that's actually something I'm very curious about. You know, I remember when Peter Hellwig was, I think he was, what his position was, he was either assessors or whatever, but I went in there, actually wanted to ask him some questions about some of the you know, the way they actually did assessments for the city. You know, tried to learn as much as I could about it. I learned a lot of the story about how they do the tax classification, you know, so you can classify property as, typically it's in Cambridge, at least it's residential versus commercial, but technically I think there's actually five categories under state law, under the Tax Classification Act: residential, commercial, industrial, open space, and one other. I don't remember what the other one was. Maybe it's institutional or something like that. I couldn't really say. But the thing is that that Tax Classification Act enables you to set tax rates at different rates based on category. And I always felt it should be actually refined a little bit more. So even within the residential category, you know, because there's a difference between like a multifamily home versus a condo, whatever, but they don't make any distinctions at all. So I think maybe, but that would require the state legislature to make a fix on that. And I don't think they're going to do that. But you know, the way it works is that you can skew the tax rates, but you can't just do it forever, right? I mean, instead of having a flat rate of whatever percent, you know, how much on the, on per 10,000, per $1,000, you can skew it. But I think right now the commercial tax rate is what, 2 point something times the residential tax rate, something like that.
It's about 2.1, 2.2 times.
Yeah, I mean, you can put it to like, I think it's
100. It fluctuates for this year. It's about just 2%, two times the value.
Yeah, but the thing is you might say, well, in order to make all the voting residents happy, why don't we just skew it and have the, you know, basically the residential tax rate be zero and the commercial tax rate be this? Because that would drive every commercial entity out of town. I don't think they could really rationally do that. And it's not legal, by the way, because the state does put in sort of guardrails that say you can't skew the tax rates beyond a certain amount. But it's all, but the thing is that if, for example, and I think this is really a concern, if there are reasons why the property valuation of the commercial sector is falling, and I think everybody's expecting some filings for abatement this year because of a lot of very high vacancy rates in the commercial sector, then those valuations go down. Inevitably, then you can't simply make up for it by jacking up the rates, you know, beyond a legal limit. So at some point, and I don't know whether this is the year, but at some point you start shifting the burden onto the residential sector.
If you're working in the financial offices of the city right now, this is probably one of your biggest concerns. You're going to have a 25% vacancy rate coming to Kendall Square. Offices are just dead, largely due to COVID, changing in work strategies. Although I think to some degree, that ship will eventually correct itself. But in Cambridge will be the last bastion of the hybrid work model. But I think the reality of it is that, you know, we have a council that is an immovable object and riddled with ideologues who just simply think that like banning labs was a good idea. Raising linkage fees to triple what it is in Somerville, more than double what it is in Boston, was somehow a good idea, even based on a 2019 study that said, don't do that. And you have a sort of litany of regulations, BUDO, climate resiliency, a lot of these things that sound great, sound awesome. We're saving the planet in the 6.3 square miles of Cambridge for the entire universe. That actually have a real net negative effect on development. And you can already see it. Go to ISD, the permits are plummeting. People are moving out of Cambridge. They're, you know, Watertown.
When you say people, you mean some of the businesses?
No, businesses are looking for places that are viable. No one wants to lease out an office space for a 10-year or 20-year lease, but no one wants to build, not many people want to build in Cambridge. There's only a few groups that are still doing it. Most of those groups have had permits already in the works. And for folks that don't understand this, it's You know, it's really like 3 years before you file a permit. So once that permit's filed, that's a result of multiple years of coordination, work, pricing, et cetera. It's something, since in a lot of ways, it's a train you can't stop. But now you have, with inflation on the cost of goods, you have increased costs of labor, the rates are, it's like a perfect recipe for total, for like what most cities would look at as a financial collapse. Cambridge is going to be a little bit more resilient because our ecosystem with MIT, Harvard has some built-in guardrails, but a 25% vacancy rate, Robert, is worse than 2008. It is horrific. And it's not going to correct itself for quite some time. And all those property owners with vacant properties, vacant, no one in there, are going to be looking to the city for abatements because their valuations have gone considerably down. And then people say, oh, well, just convert them to residential. Well, if you built a office building at $100 a square foot rent in terms of your guidelines and your financing, and now you've got your option to convert to a residential building, which the floor plates won't even work, but let's just say they do for in this magical universe, you're devaluing your building by more than three quarters in most cases. And because Cambridge's outrageous inclusionary rules, which requires 20% affordable, it becomes even worse. It's just a non-starter. I wouldn't be surprised if you see a lot of groups getting broken down for parts. I think Boston Properties is right for that. I think other large real estate.
Boston Properties is primarily, most of their holdings are Kendall Square holdings, right?
Yeah. So I think right. that they might be stripped down for parts in the next couple of years, largely because you look at the stock value, it's gone down by more than half. And people know that the headwinds are coming. There's only viable projects that I've seen are either very, very small residential. I mean, like single unit residential, hospitality, maybe. I'm trying to make it work at the Middle East site, but it's hard. It's really friggin' hard. And I wouldn't be surprised if you heard from me, 6 months from now saying, cannot be done.
Well, yeah, that might change, make for some interesting political dynamics.
But those same four people who show up to City Hall and say, capitalism is bad, socialism is terrific, we should be getting rid of labs, we should do it. Like, they have no sense of how the city works. And because they are privileged in their ability to sort of ignore reality, they make nonsense comments, bring a bunch of kids to show up screaming and yelling. And then you have that feedback loop where the council say, oh, well, gosh, I think we should get rid of labs. Even though
I've always, in a sort of superficial way, always understood economics really to be all about scarcity, sort of, yeah. How do you manage scarcity? Yeah. And Cambridge has somehow managed to be able to be sort of anti-economic, because whenever there would have intentionally been a scarcity, that somehow there would be another golden goose would show up, whether it was the lab explosion or, yeah. Or actually for that matter, even when rent control ended, then the new valuation, which the newfound valuation of existing properties was allowed to be treated as new valuation, exempt from Proposition 2.5 limits. So we were able to sort of float our values, valuations, in order to be able to pull in all the tax money to support whatever we pleased. But the thing is, meanwhile, a lot of other cities and towns were worried about laying off firefighters and police officers, what, because they had actual scarcity and there were very few golden gooses sitting around. I wonder whether, in fact, our golden gooses are all going to be basically taken a little, floating down river.
And it's going to be a downturn, and it's already happening right now. And I've always believed that when you read about it in the papers, it's already happened 9 months ago, and that you can see it amongst the Akamai is subleasing, Google is subleasing. When you sublease a space, hundreds of thousands of square feet, you're not coming back. You're gone. You're downsized. You're limiting. So Cambridge is resilient, and we have this ecosystem with labs and MIT, but it's not enough to keep everything flowing. And there's going to be a negative effect on the cost of money, cost of labor, and the cost of these regulations that Cambridge keeps piling on. And we've had this lovely thing where we can have our cake and eat it too, where some happy-go-lucky Birkenstock-wearing, dirt sandwich-eating hippie can show up at City Hall and say, well, I want this regulation, and we pass it, and MIT does the math, says, yeah, we'll pay $15 more a foot, screw it, we'll do it. But it slowly pushes everything else out, and now you're going to have an environment where MIT and Harvard are really the only big players, only real players in the city, and it's all almost like it's so disorganized and so polarized and bereft of meaning that like it's hard to listen to and talk to folks about it, where like, you know, we have sidebar conversations with counselors like, yeah, I know this is a bad idea, but you know, and you're like, okay, here come the bad ideas.
Right, but the politics somehow outlasts the reality there. Yeah, you know, so it's anyway, it's we'll see.
I'm not all doom and gloom, Robert. I mean, I'm still in the business and I still am trying to operate here, but I think there's a real disconnect. And I also think this goes back to like the city wanting to always please the council, and they come back with these, you know, these studies and glowing reports, and you're like, you know, this isn't going to work, kids. So
yeah, something occurred to me today when I was you know, sort of preparing for today, and I was thinking about some of the big issues that have come up in recent city council meetings. In other words, one of the items that came up in a sort of a big way, which in a way that I still can't say that I fully understand, was this whole kerfuffle about the closure of Memorial Drive on Saturdays, mm-hmm. right? Which was done as sort of a COVID emergency measure. Whether that was necessary or not is a completely debatable point, but you know, people got themselves worked up about it as if somehow, you know, the world was going to end if we couldn't go rollerblading on Memorial Drive, you know, on the asphalt on Saturdays. Well, I have to say I can't quite understand that.
What I thought was kind of hilarious, Robert, is like, and I don't mean to be cynical about it, though I'm going to sound very cynical, is that the reasoning behind not having the closure on Saturday was for like economic and social justice. And I'm like, gosh, everything is a social justice issue. Hooray.
Well, I mean, listen, if I was Larry Atkins and I'm living in Riverside and Putnam Ave is basically being turned into an arterial roadway, and it is like probably the single most inadequate arterial roadway you can envision, I think I might be a little pissed off too, that in fact that all of Memorial Drive is being rerouted onto things like Putnam Avenue, you know. So I don't dismiss their concerns so lightly, even though Ms. Nolan and a few others seem to treat them as if, well, that's just some poor, small little minority of people who don't really count, because don't you know, most of us, we want to be able to go and ride our little bikes on the asphalt, you know. It didn't really add up for me.
Well, I don't mind I mean, we took my son and my daughter to learn how to ride bikes on Memorial Drive, because it's one of the safer times, only save time to do it, obviously. Whether we're entitled to have it open the entire weekend, like, to my mind, a lot of this smacks of like suburbanization of cities. And I'm like, but for these happy-go-lucky bicycle people, would this have even been a conversation? And I'm like, is it bad or good or indifferent? I don't know the answer to it, but like the fact that both parties are calling it a social justice issue means that.
Well, I mean, that's the way we fight now, right? I'm more righteous. I'm more righteous than you are, you bastard.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a social justice merit badge they're all working towards, but like, it's just the discourse right now in this country, nationally, locally, it's all the same. It's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. But now I saw something else today that I guess another city press release has said that the beginnings of the actual work on River Street is apparently coming. I think is that this summer they're going to be doing some of this. They're doing test borings and other things now. Now, I don't know whether how that relates to the Memorial Drive question. But the thing is that if River Street is impacted with partial closures or restrictions for a while, and then that's sort of one way you can go. But then if you can't go that way, or it's just undesirable to go that way, you might say, well, let me just go in this way, and then maybe I'll take Putnam Ave, or maybe I'll just try Memorial Drive. So the issue about the availability of Memorial Drive as an alternative
And that
actually
that's a 2-year project, Robert. So like,
and that is a 2-year project. So
massive work on RiverStream.
Yeah. So I think maybe if I was DCR, I wouldn't be so quick to want to just sort of, you know, shut that down when in fact I might actually need that capacity.
This is a moment in time where coordination is almost required and should be all the time. But like, there's closures on Putnam, there's closures on Kelly, there's closures on lots of different side streets. All of this is going to impact that anyway. So I think this is, again, like the council does all these things where like, we got to do this thing. And then like, oh, what? There's more stuff else happening in the world besides just this? Oh, do they impact each other? Oh, crap. We should have checked into that. Why didn't someone tell me?
Yeah.
Like Spaceballs, like, God damn.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, I mean, at some level I'm saying like, sure, let's have Memorial Drive. Wouldn't that be great here? But I also just sort of want to be reasonable about these things. And it just strikes me that reason is being thrown out the window in favor of populism, you know, and I don't think that's necessarily a good way of things. Like, by the way, before we split here, I think it's at least worth mentioning, we haven't talked so much about COVID in a long while, and maybe that's a good thing because maybe there really isn't so much need to do it so much anymore. But I think for those of you who are still wanting to, you know, feeling you have to be all masked up and be fearful or whatever, let me tell you, the COVID numbers that are coming out now and even the hospitalizations are like down to close to zero around here now. And, you know, I think there's plenty of good reason to actually be very optimistic that, in fact, this is really in our rearview mirror now at this point.
I don't know, Robert. It sounds like you're a COVID denialist.
But when we were up at like hundreds of
people. This is a social justice issue, Robert. I'm sorry. It is.
Well, let's not forget there was a time when we were getting hundreds of new cases per day. We're down to 1.9.
I remember when I used to count them every friggin' day, Robert. And I'm so glad I stopped doing that. And I hope you stop doing that.
I do it now only because I feel some obligation to just keep putting that good word out there. Because for those people who maybe need that little bit of reassurance. So I'm going to continue doing it for a while. But it's really a good optimistic thing right now. Anyway, we're just about out of time here now, Mr. Barrett. So I think maybe until next time, we'll see you later here on Cambridge Inside Out.